waiting and the delay in having this next case be presented to the Court of Appeals. The panel has previously been introduced. I'm going to have our marshal, just for our recording purposes, call the next case for consideration.
Case number A230132, State of Minnesota versus Jesse Lee Fetchner.
And with that said, Mr. Wilson is appearing on behalf of the appellant. There were outside communications with the county attorney's office. Mr. Stumey was appearing on behalf of the state of Minnesota. He apparently was not aware that this matter was heard today and, in fact, is on vacation. However, he has agreed to waive his oral argument today, and he is submitting his arguments on the record as well as the briefing that has been supplied to this court. Mr. Wilson, that means that you can go ahead and make your oral presentation today. Likewise, if you wish to waive it, we would also consider your matters on your briefing as well as your record. If you choose to go ahead with your oral argument today, you are entitled to only 15 minutes. You're not entitled to rebuttal because there is no one that's arguing against you. Do you wish to go ahead and make that argument today?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. With that said, please introduce yourself and indicate which party you're speaking on behalf of. The time clock should appear on your screen as far as your awareness of the time that's allotted to you.
Certainly. Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Andrew Wilson. I represent the appellant in this matter. Your Honors, we had previously submitted two arguments for consideration on appeal. The first related to the removal of Judge Eichenwald. The second related to the violation of the appellant's right to a speedy trial. Given opposing counsel's absence, I'm going to focus my argument simply on the second argument related to the speedy trial violation as opposed to the removal issue. And from my perspective, the speedy trial violation simply involves a fairly straightforward analysis of the Barker factors. Those factors are, of course, the length of the delay, the reason for the delay, the assertion of the right, and prejudice. And on the front end, I'll simply note this court's language in Griffin from 2009, I guess reaffirming that none of the Barker factors are dispositive, and all of the factors must be related, analyzed in a related way, and must be considered together along with such other circumstances as may be relevant.
Can I ask you, before we get into your argument and analysis of those factors, to clarify the record? As I understand the record, I mean, this particular case was one of a number of matters your client was facing during this relevant time frame, and I understand that he made a speedy trial demand in April 15th of 2022. That's where I get confused now from the record. I understand the state, and you know, the record seemed to support this. The state argues that in fact the case was set for trial within 60 days of that demand. In fact, there was a June 14th, 2022 trial date, but that was continued because defense counsel wasn't available. Am I right or wrong about that?
You're wrong about that, Your Honor.
So was there never a trial date set following the April 15th, 2022 demand?
There was. There was a trial date set in this matter following the April 15th, 2021 demand. And that trial date was set for June 14th, June 15th of 2022. There was also a speedy trial demand entered in the court.
Well, let's stick with this file, though, because if it was set for trial June 14th, my understanding of the record is defense counsel asked for the continuance because your guy was in treatment, and then he was also unavailable for another reason.
Nope, that's incorrect as well, Your Honor.
All right, what is the record? Why was the trial not heard then on June 14th?
Because the state was not prepared to proceed to trial on this file because there was confusion over which court file was continued. So at the time that this case was set for trial following the speedy trial demand made on April 15th, there was another case pending, and it was a case with the court file number ending 19-2273. 2273 was previously a file, and the public defender representing the appellant was Mr. Martinez. He took a leave of absence, and substitute counsel, Mr. Lucas, took over that case. Mr. Lucas previously, prior to the June 2nd court date, got in communication with opposing counsel's office and made a request to continue that court date from June 15th to June 29th.
But you certainly acknowledge that in connection with this file, 4072, there was no less than six other separate criminal files that were all in the mix at the same time. I mean, that we can accept that, correct?
Certainly. Yeah, absolutely. The record is confusing, Your Honor, but I think the important point about that continuance related to the first trial date, this idea of unpreparedness or the state's negligence is what we're claiming.
We understand that. The fact that there were so many files, and obviously that's more of a common thing than not, it goes to the weight of the prejudice against your client.
To a certain extent, yeah. But I don't think, again, that shouldn't be the dispositive factor. The state is the one prosecuting this man, and they had a case pending against him for 4 years. He was in jail for a year at the time that he made his in-custody speedy demand.
Right, but that was a separate matter. He wasn't held in jail he was released on his own recognizance on this. But as I understand it, there was a probation violation and yet another felony, which is the reason he was held in jail, not because of release conditions related to the sex offense trial.
He had posted bond or bail in every other court file except the probation violation hold at the time that he made his speedy request, is my read of the record. And so
let's get to the prejudice factor. It seems to me that the record doesn't show a lot of insistence, not that you have to, and I understand how the factors are weighed, but not a lot of forward progress by your client as far as getting this matter to get it to come to fruition. In fact, it appears that he only argued about this after the jury had went home one day, one of the witnesses showed up with some kind of a positive COVID.
Your Honor, just to be clear, are you arguing that he wasn't firmly asserting his rights, or are you?
No, I acknowledge that on April 15th, 2022, he made a speedy trial request, but then it appears it didn't come up again in the context of this file until you were in the middle of the jury trial when a witness was unable to be produced. If there was some other time, just let me know, because that helps your client in terms of the entire sequence of events and the timetable.
It did, Your Honor. He objected to the June continuance request. He also objected to the July continuance request. Those are both of he objected to every continuance request that the state made after his April speedy trial demand. So he made his demand in April. The state requested a continuance in June. He objected. The state went through jury selection. Then this COVID issue came up. The state moved for a continuance. He objected again. The idea that, and this is, again, a pro se continuance request. He had an attorney, but he did it himself. I think that goes to the weight and seriousness of his request. But the idea that he should be required to send a letter to the court every day saying, I still want my speedy trial. You know, he objected when he needed to, when he was faced with the potential violation by the state of continuing this case over his objection. So it was more than a single time that he objected. It was June 2nd and July 14th, I believe, or July 20th, I apologize.
But returning to the prejudice point, how is the Taylor prohibition to the first two prejudice factors of the fourth Barker prong not implicated in light of the fact that the no bail hold your client had on him was based on a probation violation that had no connection to the case that's on appeal to us?
Your Honor, the reason for that is, I guess it's a few reasons that are interconnected, but the idea that he was held on a probation violation without a contested hearing, without basically it just tracked along with all of these other files, and it was the reason that he was held, that's wrong. And the district—
But if we agree with you, I mean, isn't that a problem in that file, not in this file? Because as I understand it, when the sentence was executed in that probation, that totally separate probation violation case, there was still 7 months left to serve, assuming your client got good time, right? And he only served 2/3 of that 36-month executed sentence. He only had credit for 17 months. So, and that was in July of 22. And he ended up going to trial in in August, right? By August 5th, the trial was done. And that was still well within 7 months. Totally separate. Probation violations not based on this direct appeal, this appeal before us. So why aren't those first two prejudice interests tailored out, I guess, as you might say?
Because the speedy demand in this file was made due to his pretrial incarceration, at least in part. I mean, it was due to the anxiety and concern that his attorney noted in objecting.
But he was released on this case. He was not under pretrial incarceration in this case. I mean, that the record was very clear. You would agree that he was not, there was no bail holding him on the case that you're appealing to us. Is that right?
That's correct. But he made his speedy trial demand because he was held pretrial. But for that error, had the court addressed that error and remedied that error, he wouldn't be in custody. He wouldn't have made a speedy trial demand. He was making a speedy trial demand because he was trying to get out of custody. He just won two consecutive first-degree criminal sexual conduct trials against him.
Right, but I mean, he even before he was convicted in this case that's on appeal to us, he was still presumed innocent, he executed a 36-month sentence that resulted in 7 more months of incarceration, during which he wouldn't have gotten out regardless of whether he was acquitted in this case. And the court couldn't order him released in this case because he was already ordered released in this case, right?
That is correct, Your Honor. If you look at why he executed that probation violation case, he actually didn't. He made an admission and argued for an appropriate disposition, and Judge Harris then determined that an execution of the sentence was appropriate. But he actually chose to make that admission only after the district court made the reference on record that his pretrial detention for 17 months on a probation violation hold was wrong.
Okay. Let's jump to the last prejudice issue, right? The issue of any injury to his defense. In terms of impairment of defense, your counterpart argues that you're presuming without evidence that there's some speculation, right? One of the things you point to is Mr. Pennington's former girlfriend, Marjorie, might have been helpful. What is the evidence that during the 109-day period that you're arguing is unreasonable delay, that had anything to do with, for example, an inability to locate Marjorie or any other sort of impairment to your client's defense?
I agree that's speculative, Your Honor. I don't have any proof that we would have been able to find, well, not we, but defense counsel would have been able to find Marjorie. That is as much a product of the fact that this was prosecuted over 10 years after the offense occurred. I mean, the charges have been pending for 4 years. So it's a product of the totality of the length of this case.
But that investigation could have occurred. I mean, it was charged in 2018, right? So that investigation by the defense could have occurred well before the speedy trial demand and the 109-day period, right?
I agree. Yep. The point that I think I'll make on that circles back to Griffin and the idea that none of these factors are dispositive. So I don't think that the prejudice prong is the strongest prong here, but that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And even if it does exist and it's slight, it doesn't necessarily need to weigh in appellant's favor, but the court has rejected a binary approach to prejudice. And so simply because prejudice doesn't weigh strongly in Mr. Fechner's favor doesn't mean that.
Here's the way I see it. I see administrative delays, and obviously that weighs against the state. But then your second argument about the witness not being able to be present, I will tell you, I find that to be a weak argument. Your client did not agree to have the witness appear by video. That was certainly an option. Is there anything else you want to say on that? The COVID matter and the delay that was caused as a result of that?
That witness was not unavailable, Your Honor. The state conceded that it did not seek to have the witness testify by remote means. This court had issued Tate. Tate was published. Tate was binding, even if it was on PFR up to the Supreme Court. And the state told the court, I am not looking to have this witness testify by remote means. The state bears.
And you wouldn't have let that happen either, right? I mean, I understood that neither counsel wanted that to occur. Am I right about that?
That's correct, but it's not up to the parties, Your Honor. The state could have made the argument to Judge Harris, and Judge Harris retained the discretion to rule appropriately. That's what happened in Tate. The defense objected, and the remote witness was permitted to testify over defense objection. Here, the state conceded to that. They created that problem.
I'd like to turn your attention. I know your focus this morning was on the speedy trial violation, but I wanted to just ask a couple of things about the other issue that you've presented to this court. Is it fair to say that Judge Eichenwald, before the notice to remove was filed, did not preside over or make any decisions on substantive issues in this case?
I think it depends on the definition of substantive issues, but there were no rulings on omnibus issues, and it was primarily scheduling. That's correct.
So do you contend that she ruled on a substantive issue that would prevent the state from noticing her removal?
No, Your Honor. I don't. The bigger problem with the removal notice, frankly, comes down to the guidance that's been issued in the Azure case. And that identified a concern over using removal basically as a weapon that triggered unreasonable delay, expense, surprise, inconvenience. And here, the real issue is you're in the face of an already delinquent speedy trial demand. You're at day 61. The case has been pending since 2018. The offense occurred in 2011. You've had 20 odd court appearances up till this point. It's been set for trial numerous times. Omnibus issues have opened and closed twice. And then you file your removal notice. I think that's an unreasonable delay. I think that's a waste of time. And I think that is against the line of cases involving Azure and Dahlin, Your Honors. Thank you.
May I ask a question?
Yeah, I was just going to ask if anyone had any other questions. Go ahead, Judge Eid.
Thank you. Just to follow up on that point, I take it you're not withdrawing the issue regarding the peremptory removal, correct? It's just that you didn't focus your argument on it. Is that right?
That is correct.
All right. So your counterpart framed that issue as one of plain error. Do you agree that because there was no objection below, that it needs to be reviewed for any, not only whether it's an error that's plain, but something that affected your client's substantial rights?
Your Honor, I don't believe so, because the OCC case didn't involve plain error as far as I read. And the OCC case is from the Minnesota Supreme Court. I also just see a problem with analyzing that for plain error, because I can't imagine a world in which this court, based on its precedent, would ever hold that plain error is present in a case like this.
But was that up on and I don't have that case in front of me, but was that up on a writ of prohibition as an interlocutory appeal in the first instance?
I believe so, and I acknowledge the issue with the writ of prohibition.
So that wouldn't have been plain error, because it was going up as an initial matter directly, right? I mean, versus no objection here. But I mean, do you agree? I mean, the cases that I was looking at indicate that it's a writ of prohibition is appropriate for a denial of a request for a peremptory removal. What is your view on whether or not that same framework would apply to someone objecting to granting a peremptory removal?
I think it's different. I mean, the judge is removing themselves, not presiding in the face of an active removal order. So I think that is a meaningful distinction. I think that's certainly different than removing a judge and then having the judge preside, because who do you go to for relief?
And last question, Judge Eichenwald was removed by the respondent in another matter earlier in the proceedings that your client was facing, right?
That is correct.
All right. Thank you.
All right. It appears there's no other questions. Thank you, Mr. Wilson, for appearing today. The matter is deemed submitted and a decision will be issued in the statutory timeframe. That does conclude our Zoom hearings today. Court is adjourned.